Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to Health and Safety Conversations. Here's your host, Tom Bourne.
Hi, and welcome to Health and Safety Conversations. I'm your host, Tom Bourne, and with me today is the absolute marvelous Zoe Nation. Zoe, how are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Zoe, how are you? Oh, great. Where are you based, Zoe?
I'm in Perth. Today, yeah. I'm in Fremantle.
Fremantle.
Sunny Perth.
You know, before I moved over to WA, I used to think Perth was here and Fremantle was way over here. It's just down the road. I can't believe it.
We like to stay here, though. It's the city of Fremantle. I don't like to go north of the river.
Well, I'm south of the river, but that's a different debate altogether. I've got to tell you, no matter which city I seem to go to, there's always this whole debate. North of the river is better, south of the river. I can't get it.
We get very proud and territorial, don't we?
Absolutely. Now, Zoe, it's been a long time coming on the pod, and I was a bit lax not getting you on earlier.
No.
Hand up there. But I know a little bit about you. But for those who haven't heard of you yet, can you tell us a little bit about you and your professional journey so far?
Sure. Yeah, sure. So I guess I am an engineer originally, manufacturing engineer. In the UK, I studied in the UK, and I didn't really like engineering. So I did, I think, one module in ergonomics and production line sort of study. And I thought, this is way more interesting. This is way more people focused. So then I went and did a master's in human factors, which I loved. And then I started work soon after that in the sort of consulting in rail and oil and gas. So I worked for a big engineering consultancy doing human factors. And it was around the time that sort of the result of the Cullen Report in the UK. So there was a lot of human factors work off the back of some major rail incidents that happened there. So that was pretty interesting. And then I had an opportunity to move to Australia for work. So I moved over to Sydney and I again was consulting there, doing more rail work. And this time I was focusing a lot on train design. So I got my geek on and became a massive train geek, which I loved. I've still got some of the buttons that I helped design. And so we did lots of work with guards and train drivers and all that great stuff. And then I moved over to Perth, which was supposed to be a temporary move. And I ended up working for Chevron. So I joined Chevron for 10 years and learned a lot there. So I started out with the design side of things because we were building and designing huge sort of facilities, LNG plants and offshore facilities and things. But then, of course, we started operating, and all these perfect designs that we'd spent so long on, user-centered design techniques and safety and design, all of these valves were the perfect height. And of course, we started operating and people were still making mistakes and were still hurting themselves. And so my job was really to sort of help with the investigation side of things and also be a bit proactive in trying to look at human error and how to prevent the outcomes of a human error and understand why it was still happening. So I was at Chevron for 10 years, and that sort of morphed into more of a human performance hop role, where we, around 2012, I was involved in a global program. Chevron decided they wanted to do something about human performance. We were using lots of different consultants at the time, and it was a bit confusing for people. Was this behavioral-based safety, or was this safety culture work? What is this thing? So we got together as a team, a global team, and decided what that was going to look like for Chevron globally. So I was part of this sort of design and rollout of the training, the posters, the pamphlets. It was all singing, all dancing. And I learned a lot from that, for better or for worse. There was mistakes we definitely made along the way. And then I sort of saw the impact of that as I was based in Australia, still doing lots of site work. And of course, at a corporate level, we were all kind of celebrating the successful rollout, where every leader had to train in this kind of concept. But obviously at a site level, that lands quite differently. So I had some rude awakenings there and kept learning. And then we introduced learning teams a few years later. And so again, helping manage the program for learning teams in Australia. And I left Chevron 3 years ago now and went out on my own and was consulting and still am, and work with lots of different organizations. So, and having lots of fun.
Excellent.
Trying to sort of teach people about what works, what doesn't, learning from my own mistakes still. So yeah.
Good, good, good. Human error. Let's talk about that for a second.
Mm.
Why do people make mistakes?
Because they're human.
Correct.
Yeah. No, it's that, like, we'll never go out of business if you want me to stop human error.
No.
You'll go broke trying.
I love it when you said people were still making mistakes, and I'm going, yeah, because that's because they're human. And I cannot believe, despite how far we've come in our thinking, I work a lot with supervisors in the resource industry, and I work a lot with people who are above them. There seems to be still some incredible resistance to change. I shake my head, I really do, because there seems to be the still thing about, you know, someone does something wrong, we just get rid of them. And, you know, that just, it beggars belief to me in a number of levels. And the one that I find the easiest bit to, well, the hardest bit, I guess, to understand is we don't have unlimited human resources at this time. Mm-mm. You cannot keep firing the Johns and Joannes and, you know, there'll be another clone of them pop up because there's no one. And a lot of supervisors are telling me they are running significantly understaffed in every department, but they're still in the culture of let's fire people, which just on an economic point of view, it's just ridiculous. It doesn't make sense, let alone the fact that it doesn't address underlying issues or things that have, the conditions that have led to the problems, let's just say that.
Mm. Yeah, I think recently when I was talking with a GM actually, and his frustration was that some particular work, like isolating, electrical isolations, right, one of the highest kind of risk activities that we can do on some of our sites. And his frustration was, we are based, you know, remotely. We have very limited access. One of our visions or hopes is to have local contractors and use local resources. And yet, every time this happens, we're standing people down or firing them, cycling through, and he literally is running out. So that was, that was one of his moments, actually, where he decided that something's got to change. I am literally running out of people. And it costs so much money and time. You know, it's not just the lack of it. It's the money that you have to pay to bring someone else on board and the recruitment side of things. So, you know, logically, we can sit here and it doesn't make sense, but it's such, I think it's fighting this real innate human need that when someone messes up, and, you know, when I say makes mistakes, I'm talking about errors in judgment. So maybe not following a procedure, even though you know the procedure, that's included. When someone does that, we have this need to have accountability. And we, a lot of the time, tend to think that the way to do that and send a strong message, equals punishment. And so a lot of the time I'm sort of working with companies, and my thought process is, do we need punishment and discipline to get accountability? Is it your only method? Is it your only option? Because that's that human need to seek for accountability and taking responsibility and learning about what you did was wrong. There are other ways of satisfying that human need.
Yeah, yeah. When does human error or mistakes become willful disobedience?
Ah, there's the question. Well, the problem is, a lot of the time, we can make that call too soon. So if we catch someone interfering with a safety device, and I've got loads of examples covering up a safety alarm with blue tack so you can't hear it anymore, right? You can look at that and say, that's willful negligence. That's, you know, interfering with a safety device. That's a breach of one of our golden rules. You can label it straight away. Mm. And that's the thing. The problem is that we label it too quickly. And yet, a lot of the time, the vast majority of the time, if I uncover why did that make sense to someone, you know, if I start with my assumption that most people come to work to do a good job, most people do not want to hurt other people or themselves or cause any damage. If we start with that assumption, then I get automatically a bit more curious. And like 99% of the time, I learn that that was alarming falsely for months in someone's face who has to work 12-hour shifts next to it. I've already raised a work order. I couldn't get it fixed. I've gone around and asked my boss to fix it. He said, there's going to wait for it. So my only option is that I'm going to cover this up because I have other more important things to do that I can't concentrate on. So when you start learning that, all of a sudden my label isn't quite as relevant and it changes the way I respond to my assumptions.
Yeah, it's what I've seen supervisors struggle with a bit was, even if they take on board the fact that people make mistakes and that is, where do they draw the line? Is, oh, you made a mistake, or is, this is almost a case of industrial sabotage, what you're actually doing.
Right. I think for me, it's the intent piece. So I want to understand a few things before I make that call. So, if you take each event separately, when I learn about something, even if it's the most, it seems on the surface, the most ridiculous, evil thing, I want to know a few things. I want to know the person's history. So I want to know, Bob, it's the fourth time he's done this. I've spoken to him. He's on a performance improvement plan. His behavior is not getting any better. That's giving me a big bit of context that's going to help me make that decision quite quickly. The other thing is understanding the intent. So equipment damage, a sabotage act for me is when you want that negative outcome. Mm. Now, that's a criminal act. That's someone we don't want working for us, right? It becomes a lot clearer, a lot quicker. But the gray area is when people start using those words like negligent, willful deviation, reckless behavior. And it's like, well, those things might be true, but if that person, if it made sense to that person, is it likely that someone else might have done it before? Is it likely someone else is going to do it again? You know, what's that person's state of mind at the moment? And a lot of the time they're regretful. A lot of the time I feel terrible. I've let the team down. Give me the punishment. So if you say to them, okay, so do you want to help me fix this? Do you want this to stop? How would we stop this happening ever again? And if they're on board with helping, then I've got a different path I can go down. But it's case by case. And the problem is that we extrapolate. So I'll have this conversation so much. And everyone jumps to, oh, you're just going to let everyone come on site drunk. And there's no, there's no accountability anymore. And this is, everyone can just say, I made a mistake. People make mistakes. You can't hold me accountable. It's absolutely not that. It's not no blame. It's not this extreme side of things. It's just trying to understand, are we disciplining too much? What's the negative effects of that? What kind of culture or what are we creating in our workplace? Are we getting closer or further away from it with our current approach to consequence management? All that type of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I can understand that. throw something out there. I've given this a thought in the last few days and obviously haven't been busy enough. Safety at workplaces. Is it just another name for compliance these days?
Well, I think, well, where your question is coming from is the way that we've used safety, isn't it? It's like, because I find it so interesting when you speak to people doing the high risk work, when you talk to them about safety, a lot of the time they're just like, well, I'm just doing work. It's not a separate thing for a start. So I think, unfortunately, over time, with the best intentions, we've somehow moved away from what we were trying to do with safety, which is, you know, provide some standardization and keep people safe and stop harm and learn. And, you know, when I ask people what good looks like, they want open reporting and continuous improvement. But, you know, if you ask someone, how's your safety department? What does safety do? How do you go with safety here? When they come around, we kind of tend to radio each other and warn each other to put your hats back on. And, you know, and it's like this kind of compliance checking. So I think, unfortunately, we've created a bit of a business for ourselves where we've got this reputation where we're coming and checking, you know, even the interactions and conversations. Show me your JHA. Show me how you're compliant. I'm going to test you on how you're going to be safe today. So I think over time, we've got to that point where it feels like, and especially when we keep adding stuff to our procedures and processes, we're never taking away, are we?
No. I my thoughts was, let's take what a lot of safety officers do.
Yeah.
Apart from giving a little safety spiel in the morning, which we'll talk about that again in a little while.
I love that subject, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. They go around and do inspections. That sounds like a compliance function. They look for hazards. That sounds like a compliance function. They do safety observations. That sounds like a compliance function. They check KPIs and goals. That sounds like a compliance function. I can't see anywhere in there how any of that stuff is keeping anyone safer. And it's a bit disappointing for me because let's take the safe, if that's all we're going to be, let's take this safety officer, safety advisor position and just call them what they are, compliance officer, compliance advisor, or an extension of HR. You know, I don't think that's what safety actually should be about.
What do you think it should be about, Tom?
I don't know. Helping create an environment where people can work and feel safer with less chance of catastrophic incidents occurring.
Love it.
Not zero harm, because that's just, it's nonsense. It will never happen. But recognizing people fail, systems fail, but building in a resilience.
Love it.
So that when things do fail, not that we encourage them to fail, but when they do fail, no one has to die today.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I think the fail-safe part's so important.
Yeah, I can deal with anything else but people dying on my side.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and I think that can feel overwhelming because obviously we can't do that for everything. So that's the other part I see. People trying to go down that path of building fail safes and controls that are higher up the hierarchy of controls for too much. And that's it. That's also distracting and unachievable. But I think it's a shame. And I think the opportunity is, as a safety, in a safety role, you have this amazing opportunity. If you're given it, if you're allowed it within the constructs of your company to build relationships, to learn, to remove barriers, to be the voice of the people doing the work to those who are the ones holding the budget and the control and the decision making. Like, when I've seen it work well, it's amazing. It's an extremely rewarding experience. That most people get into safety because they want to make a difference and they are people focused. And unfortunately, we are like, more and more, it's paperwork, it's KPIs, exactly how you described. It's like, can't we go back to what was intended, which is talking about the stuff that really matters? And that doesn't mean letting go of our safety standards. This is the other part. It's very hard for people to let go of what they've been used to. But it means like what really counts, what the conversations that your people want to have, because you can get to that really quickly. Like, what's concerning you? What's the worst part of this job? What would be one thing you would change if you were me? You can have those conversations much more easily than show me your JHA and why haven't you written that line item there? Yeah. You know, it's not rewarding.
All right. It's going to sound like a weird question talking to you or speaking okay. or to ask you, but there's a lead in. So there's a okay. bit of a process going on here. It doesn't seem like it at the moment, but there might be. All right. Your opinion of behaviorism in terms of safety.
So I'm not a believer of extremes. I think that it's unfair to say that something is completely wrong or there's no value in it. So for example, I think some of our behavioral-based tools, for example, are still valid and useful and well-intended. And it's depending on the organization, they're needed. So I've been in organizations where no one talks about expectations and there haven't been some clear understanding around whether we care about safety or whether safety is important. So some of that sort of more traditional behaviorist approach to safety and behavior and people in general has maybe not even started, right? So organizations where a manager is like, why would I bother looking at investigations? It's nothing to do with me. So that's like, well, we probably need to go back to helping people understand that they do have an element, that skin in the game, and it does depend on their choices, their behavior, and we want to see that consistent approach. But I think it stops being helpful after a while. And I think for me, it always goes back to Reason's beautiful quote around you can't really change the human condition, but you can change the conditions under which they work. Now, again, we can't take that to extreme because, of course, over time, the systems we design, the influence that people have on others, the culture that we work within, your behavior will change and be influenced. And you can change behaviors, but it takes more than you really should try harder. Your behavior needs fixing. So I think we've taken it to the extreme. So I'm more of my sort of camp is more in, there's some good stuff there, but we've over-focused on it. I want to look more at the systems driving that behavior.
Good. All right. The lead in was, because a lot of safety officers, when we talk about changing the environment, so where you don't have this fear environment, where we're constantly threatening workers, or not even overtly threatening them, we've seen Dave make a mistake and Dave is sacked. Now, no one's actually threatened anyone individually or come out and said this is a consequence, but everyone can see that.
Totally.
The total fear factor, which then limits reporting, which limits things changing, which limits learning why things led to mistakes or people making certain decisions. Right? That's what we don't want.
Yep.
Do you think most safety advisors, though, use a modified version of that when advising management of meeting their legal obligations for safety, though? The modified version being you'll go to jail,
which
is just an implied threat again.
Yeah.
What do you think? I don't see implied threats, whether it's going to management or to the workers, working particularly well.
I agree. And I think sometimes where some of the ideas I work with get applied incorrectly, maybe, is where we just shift the blame up a level. So, you know, and I understand that frustration, right? We say, oh, you know, fix the work, don't fix the worker. But then it's like, well, then who are you going to blame? You're going to blame the supervisor? You're going to blame the leader? You're going to shift it up to them? So it's not fair. Everyone's got their context at each level. So a worker doesn't come to work to harm themselves. A manager doesn't make a decision aiming to hurt their staff either. So, you know, understanding their restrictions and context is really important. So I'm more about sharing the accountability, recognizing that there is accountability on multiple levels. And what is that? And how do you move forward? How do you recover? How do you restore to improve it slightly going forward? So to do that, I need the vulnerability and almost the admission from the levels of the organization involved. And that is difficult because it's like, well, there's a liability question here. So where I've seen it work is, I guess, a high empathy leader that is well aware that they have a role in the system. They're curious, they want to learn, and they'll say things like, you know, I've got your back. I know that if I keep asking questions, this will land in my office, and that's okay. That's my responsibility. I need to know that. I need to help and make decisions for that. And legally, you know, you can have that conversation and say, well, as long as you're demonstrating that you're asking these questions and you're doing something about it, then you're meeting your legal obligations. Mm-hmm. You know, quite quickly, it'll get proven that, well, I was having this many JHAs filled in. Well, it's obvious if they're crap JHAs. Anyone can find that out quite quickly.
Yeah. All right.
I'm not sure if that answers the question.
No, That's all right. Now, back to safety people giving, I don't know, I'll call it the morning blurb, the morning focus.
Oh, yeah. And all cool. That. Oh, right. Love this topic. Oh. Yep.
Focus is on hand safety.
Yeah.
And they really want you to actually wear your PPE that you're required to do legally and otherwise, and be careful out there today. Is there any evidence of telling people to drive safer, be more careful, take care? Is anything more than a well-meaning, patronizing effort that achieves nothing?
So I always want to go back to, what is the purpose of your pre-start toolbox, whatever you want to call it? What is the purpose of it? And that will help me understand what someone's trying to get out of it, right? Because if they're like, well, this is when you switch on for work, and this is the key part of the day, and this will keep you safe. I'm like, what do we know about the hierarchy of controls? What do we know about effective controls and how effective conversation is going to be in terms of that? So I want to sort of peel back and understand what the aim is, because again, I'm not saying that they're a bad thing to do. They're well-intended, like you mentioned, but again, it's kind of like, well, how is it landing? What is it actually doing? Is it achieving what you're wanting? Or are you putting sort of false confidence in really what is a conversation that our guys used to have their sunglasses on, because we made it a rule that you had to wear the foam back glasses. And so at 5 a.m. in the morning, it's dark and they're sitting with their sunglasses on, you know, slumped back, not even with their eyes open. I suspect some of them were having a nap still. And, you know, to me, it's like, God, this is so ironic. So I think, when I see this working, or when I think the opportunity is it's connecting, right? It's building some relationship with the people you're working with. It's a small data point in the day where you can help to start achieving a shared mental model of what's going on, and potentially flagging anything major or anything that is concerning. So for me, it's like getting realistic. And I think this is really a big part of what evolving safety approaches could be about, is being honest about, being really honest about what's working and what isn't in our safety approaches currently. We've stood for so long, pre-starts, they must be consistent. We're going to have a template for them. I'm going to give you the data you have to go through because they're rubbish. So if I do that, I'm taking away the autonomy of the people doing it. I'm taking away the fact that the respect, because they know their teams and they know different teams have different types of relationships and different ways they interact. So I want to set some clear expectations around what they're for, and the benefits that they can have, which are flagging any issues, checking in and seeing that Dave over there isn't looking too great this morning. I'd like to just maybe have a chat with him afterwards. It's that shared approach to sort of find out what's going on, and have we got any kind of issues in terms of simultaneous operations, that sort of thing. Things like, I love when I see teams introduce humor. So I saw that once when the team was so great and their pre-starts were going so well, because they showed like some YouTube funny videos at the start. And like, what we do know is that safety messaging is remembered better when we've been laughing, or when we match it with humor. You see that in some of the safety videos of like Qantas and Virgin used to be really good at doing that. So, but then my manager at the time was like, take this, this is ridiculous. You're distracting from the safety message. Safety is serious. You know, stop showing these videos. And it's like, no, don't do that. You're like creating a really great team feeling to start the day. So creating, how do you create meaningful interaction, connection, and help remember the main things, but really don't pretend they're something they're not. And allow the team some discretion to design it the way they want, and realizing that it, a lot of the time, like anything, it comes down to that person who's leading it and their interaction and their skills and their capability and their comfort to do it. Like, are we helping them out? Are we actually spoken to them about how to talk to people? Are we helping them in that sort of skill set? Are we mixing it up? So yeah. I think there's a few key things. And when I talk to groups about that, they start going, oh, yeah, you're right. I've just been handing them out this template and a list of incidents to read that aren't relevant to them at all. And then our problem is, what's easy for us is to say our team are sloppy. They're not engaged. There's no motivation. So, I think the system's driving that.
Yeah. Yeah. Who would have thought that safety, you know, one of the key things might be, I don't know, honesty, transparency,
what?
Building relationships. Oh, yeah.
Mind blown.
I know. It's hard to improve on a lie, isn't it? I mean, let's be honest, all things that are hidden. All right. I'll give you one more question and then we'll move on to human factors and ergonomics and all the good stuff where you are immensely qualified. Saw something this morning and it was about safety observations, you know, the whole idea that we bring in safety observations in the workplace. And these are, again, a well-meaning thing, like everything in safety. It's all well-meaning to start with, at least to someone. Mm-hmm. And we'll get workers to observe other workers and give them feedback on their safety performance. But then we'll also say you have to do a minimum number of these per week or per month. And we've also got a love.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
To document these conversations somehow as a record. Is it missing a point somehow?
Where do I even start? Yeah, I mean, so I think, again, where I've seen it done well and where I've seen it fail miserably is it's, again, what's the point? What are we trying to achieve? And there is, you know, there is good research saying that getting leaders and people out there and observing these behaviors and having interactions, that's a good thing, right? So again, well-meaning. And so I think the value that we have, the value it can add is that you are interacting with people doing the work. You are learning. So if we go out there and we change the sort of frame a little bit, I want to change it from checking to learning. So this is about leadership in general, and what we know is working in leadership and what needs to change is we're going from, I hope, a sort of command and control I know the answers. I'm the thinker. You're the doer. I need to tell you what to do. I need to check that you're doing it. And what we're learning is that over time, that's not really getting us the results that we want or the improvement that we want. So we're learning that sort of leadership, good leadership, is changing to more of a relationship building, listening, enabling. I'm going to ask stupid questions. You teach me what I should be focusing on. You're the master of the work. But that's that in itself, whether it's safety or leadership in general, is quite hard because we are supposed to be trained safety experts. We need to tell you what to do. People are like, yeah, but Zoe, you haven't met our workforce. Some of them are pretty dumb. It's like, oof, you know, it's like, well, there's a recruitment problem maybe. But anyway, so it's kind of going out and learning from people doing the work, asking them what help they need, what's getting in the way. So all that good stuff, you can create some amazing conversations, but as soon as you know this, as soon as you put a metric against it, a structure around it, first of all, it is so awkward. Like the people doing it, it's awkward. The questions you have to ask are no longer a conversation. Mm. It adds another thing to our already full and busy day, another thing I have to fill in. So I get why we do it. I know that we have to do an element of it and it makes a lot of sense, but how can we be a bit clever about it? You know, so some of the stuff where you're sort of trying to record those conversations, and you know, that adds complexity in terms of data management. But instead of having to fulfill a KPI, it's like, well, where I've seen it again, done well or getting better at doing it, is where we go out, have a conversation. There is no expectation to do it, but I'm going to be asking the team lots. How often do you see such and such around here? How often are you seeing that? How often are you feeling it? How often do you interact with them? Learning about the felt experience of the people. And you can do that through the existing surveys that you have, the stuff that you're already doing, pull the data you've already got, tweak the data you've already got. And then, you know, just take away one action, one thing you learned. I think the structure around I observe these behaviors. So I don't want to keep going and trying to solve the problem, but I think we've created this interaction where the person knows the only reason you're doing it is because you have to fill a KPI. Oh, it's the end of the month, is it? You've got to fill your quota.
Yeah.
That's really missing an opportunity.
Yeah. That's sad. A lot of these things are, you look back and go, absolutely well-meaning, but
yeah, of course,
implemented really poorly. All right, human factors or economics, same or different?
Depends what country you're in, depends who you speak to. I think in the UK, so I'm sort of a fellow of the Chartered Ergonomics and Human Factors Institute, and it's the terms are a lot more similar there, for example, but in Australia I found that they're quite different. Ergonomics is more, I guess, the physical interaction. A lot of people immediately go to, oh, that's the setup of your desk, and that's kind of OT sort of space. So I mean, I could go into the technical origins of the words, but for me it doesn't really matter. It's around about, you know, fixing the task for the human, whatever they're doing. And human factors tends to have a lot more, I guess, a wider field of practitioners in terms of things like, loosely, you could pull in people who are in the org development space, in HR. They're looking at how you recruit people. They're looking at how do you build competency. So it's not just that physical design of things, I guess, is the difference.
If a human factors expert covers all of those areas, okay, it's a fairly broad area. It's a fairly broad area.
Huge.
Should that be embedded as permanent within organizations as opposed to being bolt-on contractors that you bring in to solve a problem at a time and then the problem's magically solved after 6 months and you're basically all that learning and all that experience that you've built up goes out the door?
Yeah. I love this question. So, sorry, the answer depends. It depends. But I think, yes, yeah, so you make a really valid point. I've seen it both ways. I've done both roles and it can work really well. So I always used to say in Chevron that I really wanted my role to be redundant. soon at some point, because I wanted the skill set to be embedded in all the different roles. So I sat in the stage department, but I really didn't work with, I worked with operations. I was really with them the whole time. But what I would love to see, or what I think when I think it works really well, is when you get that skill set more embedded into the more general safety roles and into operations, certain operations people as well. So I think the end goal is always, you don't need that. You don't need that skill set. It should be, but that's, I think that's a pipe dream, because there are some very particular skill sets and requirements. So a deep understanding of human psychology, some of the tools that we use are quite intricate, quite detailed, human reliability assessments and analysis, task analysis. So there is, I think it makes a lot of sense, depending on the size of the organization, to have an internal body, like process safety. We used to sort of say that, well, you know, you've put out a job application for this human factors thing, and you're just employing general safety people. You wouldn't do that with a process safety role. So it's an important skill set, I think. And it does work well inside an organization if you've got that size. I think that, you know, ultimately, if you embedded it, there's some great opportunities. But smaller organizations aren't, I don't think that's necessarily realistic. I think that would be about trying to focus on, what's your highest risk activities? Have you embedded some of the ideas, tool sets in designing those, in predicting error in those, in creating fail-safe solutions there? I do get frustrated when we see external consultants coming in, and this used to frustrate me when I was inside an organization, coming in with a program or a silver bullet, or this will fix everything. And these problems are complex. They do not have simple solutions. They're about long-term, embedded, sustainable change, which is not very sexy.
No. I may have watched something of you on a YouTube video recently where you said, I've got some very bad news. These are not quick fix measures. These are not measurable. These are da, 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 and you went through everything. And I went, oh my God, the bean town has just walked out the door, because we can't just tick a box. It's not just automatic. We can't set a deadline on it. And a lot of the time we can't measure if it's been a success or not. And I go, yeah, it must be a bit of a hard sell sometimes.
Yeah, it definitely is, especially the measuring piece. But I think you counter that with a lot of the work we're doing is really good, and we have come really far. And a lot of the changes aren't that huge. You can make massive differences and impact the safety, well-being, and performance of your people by tweaking what you're already doing. It's just really getting an understanding of what that is, and throwing out some stuff as well. Like, we don't, like the removal and decluttering. I love the term that Provan uses, that Drew and Dave use. So I think that's the good news, and that you can over time measure success, and it's multifaceted success, right? But it's a long game.
All right. What practitioners? What do they do?
The age-old question. Well, the good ones, I believe, are looking at, how do we improve our operational learning? How do we become learning organizations? Because there is so much frustration that we are no longer learning and improving, you know, and our data, our safety performance is telling us that. So I think for me, the common voice I'm hearing of frustration is, we just keep adding more stuff. We're making it more difficult. We're getting more disengaged crews. We're not seeing any kind of marked improvement. In fact, we continue to repeat the same things. I'm having the same conversations. And we just keep loading more stuff onto people, more programs, more shiny stuff. And like, when you speak to those closest to the work and those people outside of safety, they're like, oh God, not another safety thing. Here we go. This is a nice shiny new thing, is it? So I think I feel a bit of a responsibility in what I try to do with our kind of community doing this work is, we can't sell this as the next safety thing. It isn't. It's about continuous improvement. And in fact, more and more I start talking to companies, I'm like, maybe don't use the word hop. You don't need to use it.
Thank you.
If you need to label it, I get it. But really, this is about how do we continuously improve? How do we learn? How do we stop these repeat incidents? How do we build better relationships? And so I've learned kind of the hard way that sometimes the actual labeling of it, we're just doing business with ourselves again. We're doing the same thing again. Mm-hmm. So what I would love to see is more, just more general work in trying to innovate and improve what we're doing. We don't have to call it hop.
Good. Your opinion on learning teams?
Yeah. So learning teams are amazing. I've seen them work. They've had hugely beneficial impacts in some spaces that I've worked. Again, though, they are not the silver bullet. And like any, I guess, practice or tool, they can be applied badly. So I was recently working with an organization and they've done a lot of work, really great work, and they're sort of senior levels right at the very top of their organization in terms of changing the measurements that they're using. They've taken away like TRIFR from any kind of bonuses and they don't really report on it anymore. And they're really focusing on like those significant events. And they had some training and learning teams and they're like, oh, this is brilliant. What's there not to love about learning teams? That's the answer. And so they've basically rolled it out to say, everyone do learning teams. Mm-hmm. Everyone do these learning teams instead of ICAMs. Everyone do learning teams instead of Five Whys. Oh, and also we're going to ask you to do one a quarter and it's going to be against your bonus. Like, no. So of course you go and speak to the guys doing them and you're like, oh, learning teams, do you like them? And normally my response from people who've gone to them are like, they're so cool. They're like, oh, we hate them. We have to do it. Like, and it's like, we've done it again, guys. We can't help ourselves. So I think they're awesome. They're nothing revolutionary. This is, you know, people have different names for them. We were doing them. This is the only way we did work in human factors. We engaged with end users. We asked them to solve the problems. And it's another way of doing that, using appreciative inquiry techniques that have been around for ages. So it's got it's a bit of a buzzword. So again, it's like a request to our community is don't just throw them around as the silver bullet. They don't work unless you have some context and the right leadership who are curious and do want to know their role in the problem and do want to follow up on the ideas raised and are comfortable to hear some of the bad news and the reflections on their own leadership style and decisions. All that stuff comes out as it should. That's what they're designed to do. So they can fail if we don't set them up in the right way. So great tool, but the right people need to be there to sort of set them up. And the other part is one of the really great ways they can be used is if you allow the people doing the high-risk work to own them. So, I mean, that was something I learned in designing a program is that we almost over-programized it. So you had this whole like, you know, you had to have certain training and you had to be mentored and then you had to be checked and you had to use a template. Actually, where it works really well is someone just had a near miss with a forklift and the crew gather around a whiteboard and go, right, what went wrong there, guys? What do we need to learn? What do we need to do? We need to change anything? So we're not blaming the person. We're saying, let's see, this is a bit of a close call. Let's work through what you want to do about it. Whiteboard it. Come up with the ideas. We can fix that now, but we need some leadership help. We need some budget to do this one. Let's put that forklift out of order for now while we wait to hear back. Take a photo of the discussion, and that's your record for that investigation. And that's amazing. That's like learning there, and that's the people learning that need to learn and sharing where they need to share.
Does it require long-term commitment from management to stay the course?
Well, I mean, it depends. You can do them. Anyone can go and do them, do a spot one and have a great conversation and you've learned something there. But if we're going to actually try to use them and implement them, so one way I've seen them used is as a as an alternative tool for investigating, whether it's investigating a problem or looking at management of change, or whether it's actually investigating an incident. So it's been added to the suite of tools. Again, like anything, you can drift away from the intent, and we can go back to our learnt behavior if we're not careful. So yes, it is a massive commitment from leadership. They need to be the ones turning up, kicking off the learning team and saying, I really do want to hear the truth. I know that you might feel that there's some blame going on. I'm ready to hear what you've got to say. And then the challenging bit is when they go, well, you come up with loads of great ideas. And it's quite daunting because you can get this massive list of things to do. So we always want to narrow down and say, what's priority? What the top three things? If we do nothing else, what would you go after? The other stuff's great, but you know what sort of culture we're in at the moment. You know what, we've got some cost savings going on. What would you do if you could only do these top things? And then the commitment piece is acting on them or feeding back why you can't act on them. People understand you can't do everything, but they need to know it went somewhere. Mm. And that's the challenge with any investigation, never mind learning teams. So we have to be careful we don't just create more stuff that doesn't get responded to, and you get a disengaged workforce anyway.
Yeah, yeah. All right, a couple of things. Organizational learning. Is it a reality, or can only individuals learn? And once individuals leave a company, do they take that learning with them?
What a question, Tom. So, yes, I do think that you can learn as an organization. Unfortunately, I think that people get confused about learning and sharing. Right? So we tend to be good at sharing. We maybe overshare. You know, we have lots of notifications, and we have lots of, we read this out in the pre-start, we have, and it's not always appropriate, relevant, helpful. So I think learning is different to sharing. It's, as an organization, I think there are already lots of activities we do that we maybe aren't having the right conversations. We're telling, we're imparting wisdom, we're, you know, at sort of safety meetings or your monthly incident review meeting, it's often an uncomfortable process. It's like sitting down and we go through slides and we break down what went wrong and we quiz the person. Why didn't you look at this as a root cause? That's not learning. But I think where I've seen that go well is you switch it around a bit and you change the whole atmosphere of that session. And it is inquisitive. And the more senior people in the room are like, what was our role in this? What do you need us to know going forward? How will we stop this happening again? What do you need from me? What was hard about this? What do you think we didn't learn? And where I've seen it even better is things like changing the language, like the way we talk about learning is really negative a lot of the time, because we do investigations and witness statements and it's an interrogation. It's a police investigation. I'm not creating a learning environment from the outset. So it's like, what language can you change? What's the felt experience? What's going to motivate me? Like, where I've seen this done, it's like amazing, is the people involved in the incident came to one of those senior leadership meetings and talked about what happened. Now, the year before, that would have been unheard of and terrifying, and it would have been an interrogation. But because we did a lot of work, and because we had the right leadership who were inquisitive and showed huge humility, they created that atmosphere. It was like, oh, can I come to that next one? Because I wanted to share what I saw. They need to know the truth about that. And they'll show pictures of like outrageous non-compliance on a site and trigger the conversation. And you'll have a chance to learn about, well, the reason that crane is there is because of all this stuff going on. And that decision that you made has had an impact on that. So that schedule that you're pushing is why that crane is there. It's like, oh, penny drop moment. So I think it's possible. But your question is so valid about, it does rely on leadership at a certain level being humble enough to and curious to ask those questions. And when they leave, it can jeopardize. And we go back to our learned behavior. We go back to those company structures. So if we build structure around it, it's more sustainable and it relies less on the individuals. But that, again, that does take a bit of time and it has to be established to be the way we do things around here, right?
Yeah. Apologies, I have thrown a lot of questions at you, just general safety questions. because I actually value your opinion. And a lot of people, I wouldn't ask some of these questions because I was like, oh, yeah, I know what you're going to say, et cetera. So, one, I want to throw at you again just to get your opinion. A lot of companies I deal with still operate with this wonderful concept called chain of command. Do you like it or not?
You already know the answer that I'm going to say.
I think I know. Are you going to say it depends, and then you're going to give me a plus and a minus?
I think, like, so I'm trying to say it doesn't depend. So mostly, okay, I'll be a bit more clear on this. Mostly I don't really think it works, right? But of course there are certain organizations and a certain risk profile where it absolutely works and is the only way to work. So you're looking at military and looking at, you know, the defense organizations, but there are still limitations to it and there are still changes in their leadership style that they're learning about, right? So unfortunately, it was this sort of chain of command, transactional leadership, whatever reason it's evolved that way, and there are multiple reasons for it. A lot of organizations do employ ex-military leaders, right? And so that's the style that they've been brought up with. That was big for us in oil and gas. And also, we have rewarded our leaders for doing that, right? We have built our performance management systems around getting results and being quick to make decisions, right? So learning takes time. And it involves engagement with people. And that is not always quick. And so we're just like, just make a decision. Just show you're strong as a leader. And so that sometimes equates to not engaging with people, overriding what we're hearing. And I even see it in those really senior meetings that the actual atmosphere in the room is like, make sure you're definite about what you're doing and saying. There's no space for uncertainty. You can't say that you don't know. Like the whole kind of attitude in the room is like, no one would ever say, actually, I'm not sure about that. Can I go and find out and get back to you? That is not often very acceptable. So again, someone was talking to me the other day and they were part of a really big organization. And they just were using a beautiful example about the difference between the two types of leadership, right? They'd been in one site. This is within the same organization. So you have it, of course, across different, inside an organization, it differs. And they'd been at one site where they'd been to this really sort of senior leader meeting. And it was quite formal. And everyone was answering the questions and everyone knew the answer and everyone's very clear about the direction. And then he went to another meeting at a new site that he was starting at. And he was like, I can't believe how different it was. It was actually a really, it was a kind of a discussion where people were going back and forth and were solving problems. And people said, I'm not sure. Can I check? And it was, people were able to say that. It was more human and the culture was more comfortable. Now, it doesn't mean that people weren't making decisions or moving forward. I think that sometimes the concern is that sometimes you just need to show your line. It's strong and I need people to know my expectations. You can do all that and be a kind person. You can be strong and be kind. You can set clear expectations and listen and learn. So, you know, I don't think it works if you're trying to achieve a organization that is open, that there's trust, that there's good relationships, that you are hearing the problems, that your culture is informed. That's the thing, right? It depends what you want. If I want people to get on with things and I want to have 100% compliance on the surface, then I can rule with the fear of God. And that's all I'll ever hear. I'll only ever hear that everything's fine. Everything's fine. But if I really want to look at keeping people safe, what we know about keeping people safe is an informed and open culture where it's safe to speak up and safe to bring you bad news, then I don't think it works.
No. Good. Kind of where I'm at. I'm a bit more openly cynical of it, perhaps. I go, in companies where, in organizations which aren't military, police, emergency services, etc.
Yeah.
It's designed to stop people at the top being bothered by little people with little problems, which I just think is patronistic and arrogant. Absolutely. To start with. And it stymies progress. It stymies improvement because you have to go to this, and then you get no satisfaction. You go to this and this, and there is no quick decisions made. There is, but it's still surprisingly in a very lot of organizations, and it's not even questioned. It's not even questioned, and that's a disappointing thing. I will never say I'm right and someone else is wrong, but I just want people to actually question the systems that are in place and to see if they're actually appropriate and if they're working as they were intended.
Yeah, the curiosity piece.
Yeah.
I think you're right. You know what the good news is, though? Our younger generation of leaders are very different. That is not how it's going to be, I don't think. It's going to evolve naturally.
I hope to see that. I hope to be around to see that. I really do.
I think we will.
Maybe. All right, so one more question, and then we've got to call it quits because we both got stuff to do.
We do.
All right. You asked me. You stole my question early without even thinking it. So I'm just going to reverse it, hold up the old, reverse card. What does safety mean to Zoe Nation?
I mean, to me, it's about doing good work and learning and enjoying what we're doing and being clear about what our points of no return are, what our critical activities really are, and having ways that we can fail safely for those. It makes me very sad that it's become a dirty word in some circles. I just think, in some ways, again, as I said, when you speak to people doing the work, they don't see it as a separate entity. It's just like, I need to get this work done the best and the safest way that I can. And there's a million things that I need to weigh up every time I do this. And it's different today and it's different tomorrow. And so I would like to see it become and continue to become, I guess, more an entity. It's like, the outcome is that you get safe as we possibly can be. Like you said it before, right? We're not going to get zero harm. And that is still a really difficult conversation to have. And people have been sort of tied to it for such a long time. But that's, again, that honesty piece. Can we have an honest conversation? What's working, what's not? The people doing the work are the ones that are trying desperately to keep themselves safe enough in the environment that we give them. It's not like they have free will all the time. That we've given them the tools and we've given them the people and the time. They didn't choose any of that. So I think, it's a lot of things, but it's really like, how can you continuously improve, continuously learn? It's not separate to work. It's just getting work done the best way that we can and not really seriously hurting anyone as much as possible. And when we do, it's looking after all of the people who are involved and caring for them and understanding what their felt experience is and learning about it. Not a very good definition, is it?
The interesting thing is I've never met two people, if you ask them individually, who will come up with the same definition.
Right.
It's the term that underpins everything that people do in, as you said, a whole industry that we've created for ourselves. And no one can agree what it is. And it's one of those interesting things, though.
Yeah.
It's almost like, well, how would you define a good life? Anyway, you may have seen in the background the lovely dog, Shifu. He's been back and forth, telling me it's time for me to go.
It's very polite.
Zoe, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you today.
Me too.
And thank you so much for coming on, and I look forward to speaking to you again soon.
Yeah, I'll see you around locally. We're both in Perth. So thank you so much. I really appreciated your time and your questions. They're so well thought out. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Health and Safety Conversations with Tom Bourne. Until next time, stay safe and enjoy the rest of your week.